on CKUT 90.3 FM.
I'm Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. You're listening to CKUT. Keep listening.
Today on Wings, the topic is accents. Accents in spoken English and what that has to do with caste.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The English language is spoken all over the world, but it isn't spoken everywhere the same. For producers of international radio programs, this is an especially interesting topic, because we are always having to ask ourselves if the majority of the audience will be able to understand the accent of a given speaker, and what can we do to help make the content clearer. Today on Wings, you'll hear a program by Mia Kim that is all about accents, what they are, who has them, and what people experience because of having accents that other people don't understand, or perhaps won't bother to try to understand. Please listen carefully, and at the end of the program, drop us an email at wings@wings.org with your own opinion as a listener about accents.
Well, everybody has an accent. I am Rosina Lippi, former professor of linguistics. An accent is just a combination of features specific to one individual's language. So, for example, the way a sentence is strung together. In Illinois and Chicago, people are likely to say, one person says, I'm going to the store, and the next person will say, can I come with? And instead of, can I come with you? That's a regionalism. If you're talking about somebody who speaks English as a second language, that kind of accent is, they come as an adult or as a teenager, you start to learn English, say your native language is German or your native language is some variety of Chinese, you bring to the language you're learning your phonology of your native language.
My name is Evelyn Elohalt. I'm from Côte d'Ivoire, West Africa. I'm the program supervisor of the African Women's Coalition. I would say almost, 4 years and 10 months. I took for 5 years classes like once a week when I was in middle school and high school, but it was British, it wasn't American.
An accent doesn't mean that a person cannot be fluent and persuasive in a language. It just means that it's the markers of their original language, of their mother tongue.
With the British English, I improve also my English by working in international organizations in Italy and through my school, my university in Italy. And I also work for the Pope, for the radio, the Vatican radio in Italy. I also work with the United Nations agency called FAO, the Food and Agriculture. So there in Italy, I was using Italian as well as English, but still it wasn't enough. For me, my first time when I came here to Portland, my English was very limited. And I realized now I really need to learn American. Also, when you are in a survival mindset, you need to learn the language to be able to live, you know. So I just learn, and it's my seventh language that I learn.
In terms of language, the way it happens is this. One group of people, and they're in specific social groups. So, for example, broadcasters, teachers. One group of people tell another group of people, we are the masters of language. We speak English or what depends on what country. It happens everywhere. We speak English. We write English in a superior way to you, and you will never, ever succeed unless you accept our model of English and approach it in exactly the same way we do. And if you don't, then doors will be closed and opportunities will be cut off because you are not speaking the proper form of English. And they are able, and they have been able, amazingly so, to convince people that that's true. So to somehow convince half the country, for example, Southerners or people who grow up speaking Black English vernacular, that their language isn't good enough, that is part of the language subordination model, that they managed to sell that bill of goods to so many people to say, for example, your English isn't good enough to have this job because you can't communicate, you can't get across what you want to say. The same thing goes on with people who speak English as a second language, people who are told that unless they can get rid of their foreign accent, you know, that they won't fit in, that they can't communicate.
I'm from Laos. I work for the Refugee Resettlement Program for about 23 years now. 1976, I came to America. The first time is very difficult for me. I had to go to school at night for this English class. And the daytime, I had to work because my country is not, you know, it's very small country and it's not like America. The culture and other thing is different. The English is very difficult for me too.
There is no such thing as standard English. When you're talking about spoken language, variation is the way language works. Variation is not optional. It's not something that you can school out of your language. Variation is there at all levels in all aspects of your speech, from pronunciation to word choice to syntax. So if somebody tells you, well, I speak standard English, they think they're speaking standard English, but in fact they're speaking English like everybody else. Maybe the markers in their speech are more associated with more educated people or with more wealthy people, but that's still variation. It doesn't mean it's no better or worse than any other set of variation. So if somebody says to you, you need to learn standard English or you're never going to make it in this world, what they're saying is you have markers in your speech which are associated with social groups who are stigmatized. And people don't like to admit that those social groups are stigmatized. So instead of saying, you sound black, or you sound like you came from Asia, or you sound ignorant, or you sound poor, they won't say those things. They'll say, you don't speak standard English. That stuff is a matter of social evaluation that doesn't have anything to do with the language itself. And the other thing is, and this is really the sad thing, is that people who buy into the subordination model, so for example, people who come from an area where there's a very stigmatized variety of English, and they go and they try to get rid of their accents, and they learn another variety of English, and they study and they study and they study, and sound pretty much like they want to sound when they're done. But that doesn't change the underlying reason they're being discriminated against. People are saying, oh, well, if only you spoke like us, right? If only you spoke real English like we do, then all doors would open to you. But the fact is that that's not true. Discrimination will be there for another reason then. Oh, if they can't discriminate against you on the basis of language, they'll find another reason, or they won't find any reason at all. They just, you know, won't talk about it, and they'll discriminate anyway.
When I first, you know, come to the country and I work at the restaurant and I don't understand what did they tell me to do. So the boss get mad at me and they fire me. And so I say, oh, one day I can speak English, but my action is not good. But I, you know, I doesn't care about that. I try hard to express my word, you know. So I just think I can speak 4 or 5 languages. I speak Vietnamese, Chinese, Lao, Thai, and English.
Have you ever been in an argument where somebody says, you know, you two people speaking the same language, you know, a family argument, and somebody says, well, I just don't understand you. Basically, they're saying, I don't want to understand you, I refuse to understand you. Right? And that happens all the time. And that happens especially, that is something that's happening a lot when people say, well, I don't understand that person. He's got an accent. People are much more capable of understanding other people with accents or without accents if they're open-minded, right? normally in a conversation. It's a responsibility of both sides. But the minute the person notices you've got an accent that I don't like where you come from, I don't like anything about you, they'll just shut down and say, it's all your responsibility to make me understand, which is just ridiculous. But that's what's going on, basically.
There was an incident that happened at the store yesterday. I was looking to buy a candle. And I asked the store manager, I say, would you tell me, where I can find the candle? I mean, this candle. And she hears something else. And I was so embarrassed. I'm not going even to repeat the word that she said. But I felt like, no, I don't want that. I want this candle, you know, because we have a mother that has a baby. So I was going to bring her a gift and share with her. And this is a symbol of light because a new life can come in. So I wanted to give that to her.
If we really are a society that welcomes diversity of all kinds, then why do we want homogeneity in language, right? If diversity is what we want, why does everybody have to sound the same? There's so many people who come to this country with so much to offer, and they're discouraged because the language they have to offer it in is rejected. Now, in fact, if you reject somebody's language, you're rejecting them. People don't want to admit that, but that's in fact what goes on.
I am Dora Reina. I am from Mexico. I am an accountant. I am in the school right now. Every quarter, I take one class, English class. In the stores, it's very common. If I ask for my size, and the most people, they are nice and trying to understand what I say. But in other occasions, the people is busy or they don't like the Spanish people or I don't know what exactly. But they say like, I don't understand you and please no. Just I don't understand you. They are so nice with the others, but maybe not with me. Maybe because they don't have take the time to understand what I said. Sometimes I say to her, you have to be patient or please let me talk with your manager. The supervisor is very nice, always, all the time. I never meet the manager or supervisor like, you are Latino, go away. Or, no. It was always it's like, no, this is really bad. What do you need?
The media claims a lot of authority in matters of language. I'll never forget about 10 years ago, maybe more, there was an ad for one of the major news stations. I think it was Peter Jennings. And it was his big face up on a billboard, and it said, the language of authority. And I just remember thinking, oh, my gosh, why give this man any authority? He does a good job of sitting there in front of the camera and reading the news, but why does that give him any authority in matters of language? So the media claims a lot of authority in terms of language, and we let them have it. And they will say, well, you know, we speak a standard English because we're communicating across great distances. Well, they don't. First of all, they don't speak standard English because there's no such thing. They just speak a particular variety of English. It happens to be less stigmatized than others. I think basically the media needs to get over their obsession with their own importance in terms of setting language standards.
You have an accent, and I'm just like, what accent do they hear? Because I speak 7 languages, so it's a mixture of Abure, Nushi, Baule, Spanish, Italian, and French. So what kind of, you know, mixture is that? And at the beginning, I just felt like it was a way for them to tell me that I was a foreigner, that I was not accepted. And I thought that was really, I don't know how to put it, but just kind of like a way to marginalize me. And I really didn't like them telling me, you know, asking me, oh, you have an accent. I was just like, and it was really frustrating, and I always felt hurt. But then one day someone told me, oh, you have an accent. It's so pretty. I'm just like, oh, an accent, my accent can be pretty. So that's where I realized that I shouldn't be taking it personal. And I just started listening to people. I started traveling. You know, I went to South Dakota, New York, Chicago, and I hear Americans. And I'm just like, oh, no, they have an accent too. So then I'm just like, okay, everybody has an accent. I shouldn't be, you know, sick about that or feeling hurt about my accent. And I love the way I talk. I love my accent. I love the speed. I love the tone of my voice and how I pronounce my words. Sometimes people don't hear me or they hear something different.
So let me ask this. Think about this. Would they refuse somebody speaking on the radio if they had a French accent? Probably not. Because why? Because that's culturally acceptable, because that's high profile, because that's considered a good thing. But somebody with an African accent, they might say, oh, no, no, we can't do that, right? That doesn't have to do with the accent. That has to do with social stigma attached to the accent and the place the person comes from. I would say before you claim that people won't understand or that people won't like it, you better look very hard at what the underlying presumptions are. Are you assuming that people won't want to understand somebody who sounds like they're from Africa or Asia? And if that's the case, then the law actually doesn't allow that.
My name's Tracy Derwing, and I'm a professor in the TESOL program in educational psychology at the University of Alberta in Canada. Second language learners tend to have accents if they've started to learn the language after early childhood. And there are very few people who can acquire a second language after early childhood without any trace of an accent. You know, there are some exceptional people, but for the most part, most people are going to have an accent. And it's because of the influence of their first language. They've already mastered a first language, and they've developed certain patterns to produce the sounds in that first language. And those carry over. They transfer over to the second language. I conducted some research a few years ago with some colleagues where we were looking at seeing whether we could train listeners, English speakers, to understand accented speech. Because our students always complained that when they talked to their ESL teachers, they had no trouble making themselves understood. But when they talked to members of the general public, people just wouldn't understand them. And often they said that they could just see it in their faces. As soon as they heard someone starting to speak with an accent, their faces would shut down, like they would just stop listening. In this study, we tried to see if we could teach people, native speakers of English, to become better listeners to accented speech. And the people we chose to work with were students in a social work program. What we did was we took three groups of students, three classes of students in this social work program, and one class received no instruction, so they were the control group. One class received instruction where we met with them 8 times over 8 weeks, and we exposed them to snippets of Vietnamese accented speech, so they had exposure to accent, and then we designed lessons that were tied with their social work topics. So they had sort of sociocultural lessons tied in with the accented speech that they were listening to. And finally, we had a group of students who received exactly the same amount of exposure to Vietnamese accented speech as the second group. And they had the same sociocultural lesson. But they also had an explanation about how Vietnamese speech is accented. So we explained to them how Vietnamese is different from English. And we tested people before and after, where we had them listen to a passage that was read in accented speech, and they had to answer comprehension questions about that passage. They also had to listen to some sentences and write down what they heard. So we had some measure of how much they were understanding. And we also gave the people in the at the end of the session, we just asked them about whether their confidence had improved in dealing with accented speech, whether their interactions in the real world had changed at all because of the course that they had taken, whether their attitudes had changed at all, and whether their expectations that they would be able to understand accented speech had improved at all. So we did a number of measures. And in the end, what we found was that the people who had received the accented instruction really felt much more confident in their ability to understand accented speech. They felt that they were going to understand when they entered an interaction, and they felt that their interactions in the real world had been affected, as well as their attitudes. They were a lot more positive about dealing with people who spoke with an accent. Now, as it turns out, all of the participants actually improved over the course of the study. And I think that's partly because they all started to recognize that they had the ability. But the people who had the instruction in accent felt that they had developed these tools to understand accented speech to a far greater extent than the other students had. In fact, they'd had those tools all along, but they weren't using them. And the students themselves admitted that prior to doing the course, they would, in their terms, zone out when they heard somebody start to speak with an accent. They just felt, well, I'm not going to be able to understand this, so they stopped paying attention. And they became aware of that. And as we did the lessons, week by week, they started to have encounters with people in the real world who they might otherwise have avoided or not listened to, and they found that they could understand. And they would come back to class, and they'd be really excited and say, you know, this was so incredible. I was with my friends, and we were at a restaurant, and I was the one who was talking to the waitress, and the others couldn't understand her, but I had no difficulty at all. And in fact, their ability hadn't changed. What had changed was their willingness to communicate with people with accented speech and their willingness to recognize that if they didn't understand the first time, they could ask that person to repeat. It wasn't a big deal.
It's the most important to speak English very well without accent. And it's hard because we come when we are adult people, and it's not easy.
I just think that it's very sad, and I think it's the result of ignorance, because if people have an accent, and because they have an accent, they cannot be on the air, or they cannot express themselves, or their voice cannot be heard. I feel like that's not just. I feel like this is just this is just injustice, you know. And it also, for me, if I hear someone make such a comment, I will say that this is just like be ignorant, you know, because now we travel and the people that don't speak different languages or speak only their language should ask themselves a question. Why am I only hear what I want to hear? You know, they have to be open, they have to be curious, and they have to want to discover, you know, and learn another language and learn another culture. I think that's a beauty, and I think it should be an opportunity for them to open up more, to learn more, to discover more. You know, if you're talking to me and I see you have maybe an Asian accent, I can ask you, where are you from? You know, and then the conversation can go next. Discover your country, your culture, the history of your country. And that's how I empower myself, and that's how I can nurture you, and also you can nurture me, and also to be able to build up more our knowledge. Then our knowledge is not just limited to that little box that we collected all the information and we put that there. We open up. And I think that's the way to grow.
When newcomers come to a country like the United States or like Canada, they're actually bringing a lot with them. And we should be grateful that they want to come, because they're bringing a range of experiences and diversity to our countries that are really valuable. And many of the people who come are highly skilled, highly educated people who are bringing a lot to our countries. So we should want to learn from them. They're speaking English, and so they've gone the distance I think that the least that native speakers can do is make the effort to understand them. Canada's former Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, has a very strong accent, and he makes grammatical mistakes in English. But nobody ever had any problems understanding what he was saying. I mean, they often had trouble understanding some of his policies, but they certainly didn't have any difficulty figuring out what the words were that he was saying. So he's a perfect example of somebody who was able to communicate and was successful. So we need to be a lot more flexible, I think, and recognize that we're bringing biases with us when we listen to anybody. It doesn't matter who that person is. And we need to check that and think, oh, wait a second, you know, maybe I do have a bias and maybe I should try to overcome that. The media is supposed to be a reflection of what society is about. We should be hearing more accents on radio and on TV. I mean, we definitely should be, because there are lots of accents around. And I think it's a mistake that there aren't more accents, just as a part of the natural course of broadcasting. And it seems that responsible media would want to reflect their audience. And their audience includes people who speak with an accent.
For the American, they been to the Asian country. They understand us, and they can slowly to talk to us. You know, they can use another word, easy word to talk to us. And they pay more attention to listen to. But for the American living, never go out to the country is different.
I think we shouldn't be ashamed of our identity, because I think that accent is part of our identity. And I remember someone telling me at the point when that was hurting me, my accent was hurting me, I heard someone tell me that I should go to school and try to take like a class to change my accent, to make my accent disappear, because this class is like that. And thank God that I didn't do it, because I don't want my accent to disappear. If that disappears, it's just a part of me disappearing. And I just don't want that, because it's part of my history, it's part of who I am, it's part of my identity.
I try to say the American people, the Latinos and Asians and the other people like me with accent, we are the reality here in this country. And maybe they have to work with us in that, because it's the best way for stay together here. And it's a lot of work for both parts. But I don't know if they can do it, but for my part, I want to try.
You've been listening to the radio program Accents, produced for Women's International News Gathering Service by the award-winning radio producer Mia Kim. Mia Kim, who is from Korea, often omits her own voice from her programs because she has been shy of what listeners will think about her accent. Wings invites listeners to contact us with your own opinions about accents. Do you love all kinds of different accents the way we do? If you have a difficulty understanding someone's accent on radio, do you listen harder or do you tune away? Have you suggestions for Wings on how to help you understand new accents? Our email is wings@wings.org. Wings is a weekly program supported by your local radio station and by direct gifts and grants. Again, our email is wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of numerous works on the subject of the gift economy.
Find her series of events at maternalgifteconomymovement.org.
The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast.
I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Fade. Sergio Calypso's Tour 2024. Live at Bell Center, Saturday, June 1st. tickets now at evenco.ca. Fuego Fuego, el festival de música latina más grande de Canadá, está de regreso con los artistas más populares del género urbano. No te pierdas a Maluma.
Ay, otro chisme más que te cae.
Raúl Alejandro, Mora, John Mico, Ivy Queen y muchos más. 25 y 26 de mayo en el Parque Olímpico de Montreal. Dos días llenos de fiesta, ritmo y sabor latino. Consigue tus boletos en festivalfuegofuego.com. Ya están a la venta.
What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month, so you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Hi, this is Bonarogs of Third World, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Canada, that is, for those of you who don't know. Eh? What a world. Whoa, 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 ye!
On Wings, human displacement and homelessness keep growing and growing. In a parable of uncertain attribution, there's a community struggling to save babies who float downriver in increasing numbers. And someone says, let's find out who's putting them in there. Brazilian environmentalist and organizer Magda Renner made it her duty to find out. From the Wings Archive.
Wars have always been followed by harsh periods of poverty, famine, social, cultural, environmental disruption, but nothing is comparable to the devastating impact on all living beings caused by modern warfare.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Many of the world's most articulate environmental thinkers gathered at the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet in Miami, Florida, November 8th through 12th, 1991. Among them was Magda Renner, spokesperson on environmental issues for Brazil's National Confederation of Women, and for 17 years, executive president of Gaucho Women's Democratic Action for Friends of the Earth Brazil. She addressed the tribunal on the subject, global homelessness.
As we enter the last decade of the 20th century, global homelessness of millions of people around the world has perhaps become the most striking characteristic of our reality. During my own lifetime, I have seen thousands of refugees from the communist regime, from the Nazi Holocaust, from World War II, the Vietnam War, and from over 100 local armed conflicts during the pretensely four decades of peace, and despite the creation of the United Nations in 1945, the International Forum for Human Rights, and the Guarantee for Security. In 1991, the Gulf War created a new wave of refugees, and human pain, cruelty, suffering. In the history of the second millennium, it will be remembered as the gravest ecological disaster ever engendered by man. The UN estimates that there are today over 15 million refugees in Asia, in Africa, in North and in Latin America, in Europe and in Oceania. At least 75% are women and children. In some cases, they reach 90%. Women are the sole head of millions of families, and for being women, they are the most exposed and vulnerable to physical violations. The numbers above refer only to the political refugees. Wars have always been followed by harsh periods of poverty, famine, social, cultural, environmental disruption, but nothing is comparable to the devastating impact on all living beings caused by modern warfare. In the era of intelligent electronic nuclear weapons, even preparing for war in peacetime condemns people to lose or abandon their homes. On a global level, the armed forces are not only the single largest consumers of petroleum and other rare minerals, they are also, and most certainly, the largest polluters on Earth. Production, maintenance, and testing of conventional biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons produce uncontrolled quantities of toxic wastes, and the maneuvering of all the war paraphernalia leaves behind large tracts of dead land. These are the ghostly monuments, the sacrifice zones, created by a global civilization which, during years spent on weapons, every 30 minutes the whole day round, an amount of money equal to the annual budget of the UNEP, the program to safeguard the life-supporting systems of planet Earth. Such is the way leading to global homelessness for humanity as a whole. In 1985, women working for a nuclear-free and independent Pacific, a group active throughout Britain, organized a speaking tour in Europe for 9 indigenous Pacific women. I quote parts of their testimonies, published in a modest booklet. Why haven't you known? Why haven't you known about nuclear testing by the US, Britain, and France? About jellyfish babies born to women who were exposed to the tests? Why haven't you known about the effects of alien colonial, political, and military domination of the indigenous people? Why haven't you known about uranium mining and aboriginal land and nuclear waste dumping? One of these women recalls a day she'll never forget. It was in the year 1946. When the Navy official from the U.S. came to the Bikini Island and he told the Chief Judah, we are testing these bombs for the good of mankind and to end all world wars. The Chief Judah did not understand English, but the word mankind stuck in his mind because he knew it from the Bible. So the Chief gave the permission to the American official. When the Navy official came, it was too late. There were already thousands of soldiers and scientists on the atoll, and hundreds of airplanes and ships in the Bikini Lagoon. They were ready to conduct their tests. The Bikinians had no choice but to leave their islands, and they have never returned. The Navy official did not tell the chief that the Bikinians would not see their home again. Today, Bikini is off limits for 30,000 years. And there are other Pacific islands and other irradiated areas around our globe which are off limits for all times to come. Bikinians who have survived can't escape their remembrances. They suffer from homesickness, from ill health and cancer, and in their bodies they carry the seeds which generate abnormal children. Jellyfish babies have no eyes, no legs, no arms. Women who have nurtured them in their wombs get crazy when they see them. How many share their destiny among the survivors of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Chernobyl, or Bhopal? In our recent history, we have lived a moment of hope when the Cold War was over and world leaders started speaking of converting arms into plowshares. Then there came the Gulf War to liberate Kuwait, to defend what is right, and to preserve the stability and the security of the Gulf, on which the U.S. vital national interests depend. The words are quoted from Mr. President Bush's address to the nation, March 91. Technology won the war, but it doesn't build peace. To the contrary, nations who can rely on such phenomenal technology arsenals, as we have seen during the Gulf War, will easily be tempted to use them even before exhausting all other possible ways to settle their disputes. If man deserved the domination, Homo sapiens, they arrogantly gave themselves, then they would fight their wars with arrows and bows. They would develop technologies to serve life instead of sowing massive death and disaster. Today, there is a new category of homeless people, mainly in third world countries, and even where no wars in the traditional sense were fought. These are the ecological, economic refugees. They are the victims of our model of civilization aimed alone at economic growth. Since mid-century, the global economic product has nearly quintupled. On average, the additional economic output in each of the last four decades has matched that added from the beginning of civilization until 1950. At the same time, fresh water and clean air have become our scarcest resources. In third world countries, the industrialization process promoted by transnational corporations and financially supported by international development aid agencies and national governments has taken to ruthless exploitation of natural resources and has violently contributed to eco and ethnocide, as in the case of the tropical forests and their inhabitants. And this process also has definitely marginated all the poor people from the development process, from the social process, from the access to work. The Green Revolution, imposed on third world countries by decisions taken at the FAO in New York and directed by agrochemical transnational corporations, pretending to save our countries from pests, from hunger, from diseases. This revolution has instead created new pests, has eroded the soils, has contaminated all our sources of life, has concentrated land ownership and dislodged thousands of small landowners and rural workers. Now, these same agrochemical TNCs, who also detain the pharmaceutical and the seeds markets, are aggressively promoting their biotechnology and are trying to privatize all germplasm, which is the origin for new cultures and for new medicines. Today, women coming from all sectors of civil society are speaking out. They are confronting government officials and industry managers, and they are fortunately acting on their own. In 1989, when the historical meeting of government officials with Indian communities in Indian territories in Altamira, Brazil, to discuss new hydroelectrical dams, it was Tuira, the Kayapo Indian woman, who startled the audience, getting up suddenly and holding a knife at the throat of the president of the National Energy Company. Let's start the revolution. Cried out in despair and anger, when will the white man respect Indian land?
On Wings, this is Brazilian environmentalist and organizer Magda Renner, addressing the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet in November 1991.
In São Paulo, 220 women, heads of families, earning two minimum wages, hunger wages, coordinated a cooperative system of mutual help construction, supported by the National Federation of Women. Working 8 hours on Saturdays and Sundays, they are the architects and masons of their homes. They are giving us an example what women are capable to do. In Rio Grande do Sul, where the soybean plantations for export have emptied the fields and swollen the cities, many rural refugees are now reaping a living out of the urban garbage fields. One of them is Maria da Silva, who is now coordinating the Women's Cooperative for Selected Recyclables, which are sold to the industry. Maria tells her story in a few words. I was 16 when we came to the city because there was no more work for us at the soy plantations, and I was pregnant. And the only way to survive in the city was going to the garbage fields. But the father of my son could not stand it, so he went away. And I don't know where he is today. But I survived. And today I have a job. And my son is 4 years old. And we will soon have a teacher to hold classes in the church. And our cooperative received a small piece of land, and we are planting vegetables. I will have no more children. I went to school for 3 years. It is the best thing in the world. There are innumerable Marias of all colors and races, all cultures and religions, bravely fighting for survival, giving birth, nurturing life, healing wounds, providing for shelter and food, caring for the oldest and the youngest, the disabled and the poor. Women have been the invisible and the unpaid working force underlying the development process in all societies. And yet, the question I ask this audience, and in part I have received already an answer. What has been our role in the political world scenario where the decisions are taken which determine our life and ultimately determine the fate of the earth? Where have we been All the while, our sons, our fathers, our husbands, our brothers have been shaping the world, following their own social, political, economic principles and ambitions, overruling humanitarian and ecological imperatives. What brought me here is the hope for women to find the way to influence the decisions to be taken in 1992. Let us clearly formulate our demands to world leaders for women's participation at the decision-making processes. Let us stand up against the abuses of power and keep faithful to the values and principles of equity and solidarity. Let us keep in mind the limits imposed to all human activities by the finitude of our global home and by the immutable laws of nature which rule life on planet Earth. May we live up to our task today. Tomorrow, it will be too late. Thank you.
Magda Renner of Brazil, testifying on global homelessness before the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. Questions were put to Renner by a panel of women judges from India, Guyana, Australia, Sweden, and Kenya, and by members of the audience. Wings excerpts them here.
Thank you very much, Ms. Renner, for that very inspiring presentation. I'll now throw the floor open to the panel of judges who will field questions to her.
Thank you very much for your most interesting testimony. There are already some women, very few, but anyway, some women already in power.
Yes.
And have you any thought or suggestion as to how these women should use their power regarding the issues that you have risen?
You know, when I finished, I said, let us keep in mind the values of equity and solidarity. Let us keep it in mind if we reach any power situation, because it is desolating to realize that those women who have entered this competitive world of men, they have adopted the same mentality of these men. And that is the challenge for us women. Let us try to go into this world, but please let us stay to our own feminine values, those values who have made of us, those values which create the home for people with human warmth and with a heart and with the eyes opening the heart. If we are not capable to do this, to conserve these essentially feminine qualities, then it's no use striking to come into any important political position.
What can we do as a group of women to sensitize governments to the plight of the global homeless?
I think that women and all those volunteers, all those groups who are fighting for environment and development, have an opportunity before 92 and afterwards and during 92. We must be visible when all the the dignitaries, the powerful men are coming to Brazil in Rio de Janeiro. We must be there, we must be standing in the streets. We must be crying out at them. We don't, not behaving so well as we always do, just standing there. Yeah, it's true. Just standing, just hearing, and not having the possibility to speak. So if we don't have the possibility to speak during the official meetings, let us stand in the streets where those men have to pass to go into their beautiful cars. And let us make our demonstrations there. That, I would say, is the first thing, because our experience, I have been for 2 years at the NGO World Bank Committee, and always behaving very well, and writing hundreds of papers, and making thousands of suggestions, which then always were considered very enlightening, but nothing happened. But when we went into the streets with our big banners, standing in New York where it was forbidden to stay, and the police came, then it was an affair, and then suddenly all those men started listening to what we were saying. So I do think that there are several different actions to be done.
Judy Smith from Canada. I have a question or an appeal to Magna Renner from Brazil. I came here with the sole purpose of raising concern about the street children in Brazil, particularly because this conference is going to have such an impact on them as the death squads come into place to clean up the streets so that we can come to the conference and get a good impression of the situation. And I know it's a difficult subject to talk about, but it's one we have to address because it's something we can talk to before the conference happens to try to put some public pressure on the governments and to get. I can't see attending a conference when I know people are going to be killed, particularly children.
Mm-hmm. I give one number. In Rio de Janeiro, 300 children were killed only this year. In São Paulo, more than that. And these children reach from 5 to 12 to 15 or 16 years. Many of them are murdered because they know something about the traffic. They are used by those who make the drug traffic. And then they must be murdered because they know the people who make the traffic. There are probably other explanations also for this murdering. The worst is that these young people who don't have any school, who don't have parents, who don't have a home, they live in the streets, and they are becoming something that it's not human anymore. They are now ready to kill one another just to steal the tennis shoes one of them is wearing. We think that this is a signal of a civilization that is completely rotten, I would say. And there are, of course, the poverty which never has been like the poverty we have now in Brazil is, of course, helping to this procedure.
Brazilian environmentalist and organizer Magda Renner addressed the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet in November 1991. Renner co-founded a women's action group in 1964 that later became Friends of the Earth Brazil and joined Friends of the Earth International. She died in 2016 at nearly 90 years of age. This recording is from the Wings Archive. For a link to the archive's growing presence online, email wings@wings.org. To watch videos from the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet, visit the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose latest book is titled The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. The sound logo you heard in this archival program was created for Wings by Maggie Payne. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Sleepy King starts now.
Emergency! Emergency!
We all may go on.
We should exterminate you now. We will get our power.
We all may go on. We are a superior being.
Daleks, listen to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Tu t'es occupé de ton ami qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière en santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT, les vibrations de la communauté. CKUT FM 90.3.